I'm turning this evening to the book of Proverbs, chapter 25 and verse 16. Proverbs, chapter 25, verse 16. Hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee, lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it. And our subject, I believe, of the verses ahead of us is ruling one's spirit. Now, just to look very briefly at verse 16 before we work into the verses, hast thou found honey? It's very obvious that honey is, well, to most people at any rate, pleasant, very pleasant to taste, and mildly addictive. And many people will eat more and more of it. And then after a while, they may feel bad. And finally, they may be deprived of all nourishment by it. Lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it. It's interesting that the passage says, hast thou found honey? Found is derived from a Hebrew term to appear. It was stumbled across. It was unexpected, this particular consignment, whatever, of honey. It was a pleasant surprise, and that added to the delight. So the warning is all very plain and obvious in the illustration. There are things that are pleasant, and you may be able to argue that they're beneficial and they're good, but you can have much too much of them. Now, before we consider it any further, the proverb is almost repeated in verse 27. It is not good to eat much honey. So for men to search their own glory is not glory, or is not glorious. It is not good to eat much, and here comes an application. So for men to seek out or to hunt for and look for their own advancement, their own advantages, their own reputation and glory is not a glorious thing to do. In the end, you put the two proverbs together, it's damaging, and particularly damaging spiritually. And then comes verse 28. He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. And here is one of a rare set of proverbs which really gives us the theme, well, handed on a plate, so to speak. He that hath no rule over his own spirit. As we look down these proverbs, we cannot, by our usual method, find a common thread. That is to say, if we look down the proverbs, noticing all those that refer to neighbour, for example, to do in this set of proverbs, noticing those that mention some other term, and looking to see if there is one term which is mentioned, let's say, in 3 out of 4 of the proverbs, we think we have a common theme. There it is. Well, this block doesn't yield one up. But on the other hand, there are the two repeated proverbs, or the one proverb repeated, which suggests that it's an introduction and a closing, and then there is a simple application, he that hath no rule over his own spirit. So one may think, would that Solomon had done that to all the blocks, because it seems to be easy to see that that is the theme. And it is, when you consider them. It's about ruling one's spirit. And it's looking, this block of Proverbs, at different aspects of that. Don't be surprised that in Proverbs you have a little searching to do. They are Proverbs. The term proverb means parable. They are miniature parables. At the same time, it indicates a puzzle. It's a deliberate literary format. It's something to make you think. So the understanding of the passage is never obvious. You've got to think about it. But then it's not so difficult that nobody can come to a right solution. So we go back to verse 16, and surely this is going to be the theme, ruling one's spirit. And I move, well, I'll come to verse 17, and we'll move speedily through to cover these this evening. Withdraw thy foot from thy neighbour's house, lest he be weary of thee, and so hate thee. And that's pretty straightforward. And you can see that if you spend too much time with another person or in another person's house, you're going to outstay your welcome. And this is about consideration for others. In the ruling of our spirits, our lives, and our attitude and behaviour, consideration for others is a factor. I have to be careful to respect the privacy and the independence of other people and not force myself upon them. This has many, many practical applications. If you knock on somebody's door and you're visiting the community and you introduce yourself and you say that you'd like to talk about spiritual things, and it's 8 o'clock in the evening, don't stay there till midnight. You'll ruin all you say. You'll outstay your welcome. It's obvious. But it has so many applications in life. Don't steamroller down other people's programs and commitments. Everybody's busy. Don't interfere with other people. Their right of judgment. Some people are very swift to give opinions, and sometimes it's appreciated and their guidance is valued, but it goes to their head and they overdo it. And they're always advising and lecturing other people, or perhaps one or two other people. It may happen in marriage when one of the two wants to do all the giving of advice and none of the taking of it, and overwhelm the other party. It's very wearing and it's very difficult. So in the ruling of our own spirit, as it were, consideration for others is a major factor. Don't depend on others too much. We can't depend upon the Lord too much, but we can depend upon other people much too much. We can ask too much of other people. We can start to use other people for company because we find company congenial. And so we want as much of it as we can get. This may be our problem. So we outstay our welcome that way. So consideration for others, it's obvious in a way, but it's not simply, verse 17, confined to the application to the neighbour's house. It has many applications, and particularly in marriage, that there is a proper balance of respect and input and guidance, mutual guidance on different things. But then I go down to verse 18, and this is rather interesting, rather jolting. A man that beareth false witness against his neighbour is a maul and a sword and a sharp arrow. Well, a maul, we don't hear the term much these days, but a maul described a kind of iron club. And if you've ever seen pictures of a long iron bar with a round ball on the end of it, with or without spikes poking out, that's a maul. And it's just used to batter. And if your assailant or enemy or whatever was clad in breastplate or armour, well, a maul could buckle it and break it down if you had the strength to wield it. It's just a kind of sledgehammer adapted to the purpose of primitive warfare. But it can't be used gently. As soon as you mention a maul, you're out to kill somebody. You can't do anything less with it. If it connects with the other person, that's it. So this is death that's being spoken of here. A maul and a sword, obvious, and a sharp arrow, and the Hebrew term, so the experts tell us, particularly refers to an arrow which is intended to kill another person, not just wing a bird or something of that kind. This is murderous and destructive. Now we read the proverb again in the light of that. A man that beareth false witness against his neighbour is a maul. Well, now the advice here is that in the ruling of one's spirit, we can very usefully have some unbreachable barriers, some things that we just train ourselves not to do. We will not do them. For instance, let's suppose I have a temptation, or I have it in my heart, to gossip, to say something harmful, discrediting about another person. And the temptation may come strongly, and I may have a minor grudge. And gossip is terribly enticing, at least to many people, to certain kinds of people. But if I see it as not just destroying a reputation, but hitting somebody with a maul, or thrusting them through with a sword, or shooting a fatal arrow at them, well, I might think twice. This is a terrible thing to do. This is a murderous thing to do. This is a destructive thing to do. This is something absolutely extreme for a Christian man or a Christian woman. If I think like that, then I'll hesitate. My conscience will work. I'll draw back. So really the proverb enshrines a very wise strategy and very wise counsel. Do I want to stop myself, train myself, strengthen myself against some sin? See it in these stark terms. This is a murderous and a terrible thing to do. And I destroy the other person, and I destroy my own blessedness, an instrumentality. I take a maul to myself and to my Christian walk. Isn't that a method that will help us? A man that beareth false witness against his neighbour is a maul and a sword and a sharp arrow. I never thought of it like that, we may say. But it's good for us to think of it like that. So that's this counsel in verse 18 and what it means. It's an antidote, and it can be an antidote to many sins. If you realize their destructive nature and their harmfulness and how contrary they are to Christian conduct. So this is about ruling the spirit. And I've always found that kind of strategy very, very helpful. But then we go down to verse 19. Confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint. Well, two very painful conditions are mentioned. A broken tooth, if you've had it, can be very, very painful. And you can't eat, and you can't function. And a foot out of joint, you can't move, you can't travel. It desperately needs attention. Confidence in an unfaithful man. Well, again, you could apply this to marriage, if you wish. Young man, young woman, don't marry an unfaithful man or woman. Wait till they've overcome that. Someone who can't keep promises and always lets you down. If you overlook it, and it's serious and it's persistent, it's a deep flaw. Person has to be confronted. Person has to struggle with that and seek the help of God and overcome it. Because if not, well, marriage depends upon a great promise, an absolute faithfulness, and continuing responsibility for each other. He is mine, and I must look after him. She's mine and I must look after her. And no matter what happens, I have a responsibility. I dare not let it go. This is precious to me. If a person is unfaithful, can't keep promises, isn't reliable, they're never going to have that attitude. And that's a disaster. There's no foundation for marriage. But you can look at verse 19 another way too. You putting your confidence in an unfaithful person, presumably you know he's unfaithful. The modern versions go for deceitful and terms like that, which is probably a bit strong. But at any rate, so there's a wider compass in the term unfaithful. But if you rely on some unfaithful person in a crisis, well, then they won't be up to the mark, they won't be straightforward with you, they won't be diligent, and the results may be disastrous and very painful. And it's your fault because you weren't diligent. You were super casual. You left something important in the hands of someone you couldn't rely on. And there was a crisis, and it all went wrong. And some of you were in professions where you know about this, and you didn't do that. And when you have to leave your work or your situation, you take stock of who you've left behind and who's in charge or who's going to carry out whatever it is that has to be done. And if you don't, if you're a carefree person and an over-relaxed person and you never worry about anything, the disaster ultimately is your fault as well as the inadequate person you left in charge. So it applies to this, that don't be casual in life, ruling the spirit. I mustn't be casual. I mustn't be haphazard. I mustn't think, well, don't worry, it'll work out, it'll be all right. I don't have to give attention to it. You can't live like that. Confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble. And it really is an exhortation to us not to be slipshod and casual ourselves. But then verse 20 moves to something a little different. As he that taketh away a garment in cold weather, maybe you yourself leave off a coat when it's going to freeze. But you may be a parent and take a coat away from a child on a bitterly cold day, or a carer who leaves somebody inadequately clad. As he that taketh away a garment in cold weather, and as vinegar upon nitre, which nowadays we translate as soda, that's the term, not nitre or saltpeter or gunpowder, but soda. Well, it seethes, vinegar upon that. That's the idea. So is he that singeth songs and behaves cheerfully and happily to someone who has a heavy heart, who's deeply distressed or cast down or grieved by something. So verse 20, and it's still on the theme of ruling one's spirit, is to be a deeply sympathetic to other people. Have to consider them, we've seen that already. But you have to be deeply sympathetic. Weep with them that weep, says the Apostle Paul in Romans 12 and verse 15. Not crass and blundering and superficial and insensitive and thoughtless and shallow. So is he that singeth songs to a heavy heart. We have to be deeply sympathetic and watch our words and try and behave appropriately and helpfully and see situations through the eyes of the other person. We just had the funeral of Mrs. Ann Archer, and something that came up with Mrs. Archer was how encouraging she could be to other people. Numerous people have spoken to me of how she would encourage them in different things. So is he that singeth songs to an heavy heart. Ruling the spirit means what I say to others counts. Will I encourage? And then we go down to verse 21. And it's still on the theme. Control, anger and bitterness. You know that again, quoted by the Apostle Paul, if thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. And if he be thirsty, give him water to drink. For thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head, and the Lord shall reward thee. Now that may sound as though you feed and give drink to your enemy in order to give him discomfort. But the leading idea, probably, the coals of fire is an old Hebrew expression which represents really covering yourself with ashes, but it's very colourfully expressed. Coals of fire, it's about repentance. Why, if somebody has offended you and is hostile to you and has behaved abominably, and then they get into great need, and you show proper compassion, you may bring them to repentance. That's most probably the idea behind the proverb. For thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Not only will he cover himself with dust and ashes, but you'll be so successful, it's almost as though he's used coals of fire. That's the idea behind the expression. So you've melted his heart by your kindness. He's come to see his wrong judgment of you and has repented. That's most likely the sense. And the Lord shall reward thee. What did you do? Well, you controlled your bitterness and your animosity, and you were deeply offended. And when you saw him in great need, you extended help. So it's an aspect of ruling your spirit. You did what was right and put to one side your natural feelings about the other person. But there's a caution which runs in the opposite direction in a later verse, which we'll come to. But I go down to verse 23. The north wind driveth away rain. The margin offers you the exact opposite translation. And it is a little puzzling which is which. But I'm told that certainly in that part of the world, it would be the north wind that drives away rain. Either way, it doesn't really matter. The sense of the proverb is just as surely as a certain kind of wind will always guarantee a certain outcome, so doth an angry countenance drive away a backbiting tongue. The modern translations tend to turn this completely round the other way. I won't go into that at length, but I think they're mistaken. However, here it is, just as certain weather conditions have inevitable consequences, so doth an angry countenance drive away a backbiting tongue. And here is the rule of your spirit, and it means this: show disapproval at sin. Indicate your disapproval. Have the courage to do that. So again, let's come back, because it's easy, to gossip. Backbiting is mentioned here. Somebody comes and offers you a morsel of damaging gossip. Let your face show that you disapprove. And this is unacceptable. And they realize they've put a big foot wrong. And stop. As the north wind driveth away rain, or whichever is the right way round, so doth an angry countenance a backbiting tongue. Show disapproval. We have a duty. If we don't show disapproval, then presumably we're showing approval. And by showing approval, and people don't think about this as much as they ought to, by showing approval, you have become a partaker in the other person's sin. You have become co-responsible before God, as the teaching of the scripture, for that sin, because you did not distance yourself from it. I'm not saying that you have to necessarily verbally reprove it, but we're obligated to show our great discomfort and disagreement with this activity, whatever it might be. And usually, because the Bible says so, we will be successful. Then, as the north wind driveth away rain, so doth an angry or disapproving countenance drive away a backbiting tongue. Don't have to be rude or unpleasant. It's just obvious this does not go down well with you. You're not that kind of person. Then you've done the right thing, and you've distanced yourself from that wrong act. And that's very important in the Christian life. It's a way in which we honour the Lord and stand for what is right. It's a way in which we effectively caution and correct each other. It's a humble way, and it's effective too. And then we come down to verse 24. We've had this before in chapter 21. It is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman and in a wide house. Or it's better to rent a back room in an attic by yourself than it is to marry a brawling, or that is to say a contentious or grumbling and complaining lady, even if it means that by that match you're going to live in a mansion. Much better to be a poor man renting an attic than living in a mansion with a contentious person. Let's put it the other way round for the sake of the ladies. Much better for a lady to be by herself than married to a man that's an inveterate, hapless grumbler and groaner. It's almost unbearable. So you can have it which way round you wish. And what is this proverb that we've seen before in another context doing in this particular block of proverbs about ruling your soul and taking yourself in hand? Well, it has numerous applications. You're in business, or at least in some department or enterprise, and you're offered a promotion. And it's a good promotion, but you'll be very senior in another department. But the head of that department has a terrible reputation. Nobody lasts very long there. He gives everyone nightmares. He's so unreasonable, and so on, and unpleasant. What are you going to do? Are you going to be tempted by the promotion and the money and the status? No, says the Bible. You've got to rule your spirit. If you're not going to be able to live as a Christian in that department, then keep out of it. Don't take that preferment, that advantage, that promotion. This is about ruling your spirit. Stay where you can live and function and witness best as a Christian. Now, everywhere has difficulties. I'm aware of that. Everywhere has problems, but don't ask for trouble. Don't stay, if you have a choice, where you can't really function as a believer. That's what it amounts to. It can apply even for churches. I've been reading a book that is letters of Baptist ministers to each other in a particular period. I told a lot of people about one of these books just two or three years ago. Another one is out, many letters, many autographs, interesting correspondence, but half of this book is potted biographies of all the men mentioned. Amazing that the compiler found out so much about them all, but he did. And as you read these, quite interesting and instructive, you suddenly discover there were some churches that were trouble. Not many. They seemed to be wonderful churches, these late 18th century Baptist churches, but some were trouble. Oh, somebody wrote to someone else, "Brother so-and-so has gone there. Is he wise? We warned him. Everybody leaves broken after a time. That's a smallish church, but they seem to have five or six powerful personalities who are against everything under the sun. Born grumblers," and so on. Well, it's a testimony that there seem to be so few of these churches in the group, but there were some. And when I saw this proverb again, I thought, well, it would apply. Leave them well alone. There's a very sick church or two around where there are some personalities who are afflicted with this spirit of contention, and there'll be no blessing there. "It is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman and in a wide house." Don't go into that situation. Just as I said earlier, don't marry somebody who can't keep promises, who is unfaithful. Don't marry somebody who's a grumbler, and to wait till they get over it, if they can, because otherwise it could be lifelong and be very, very hard. So we've got to have the liberty to rule our own spirit. Now I'm going to put verse 26 before verse 25, because it enables me to end then on a positive note, and I hope King Solomon won't mind. But here in verse 26, "A righteous man falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring." Now you could take this two ways. A righteous man who succumbs to the wickedness of the wicked. In other words, he allows himself to be subverted by them and to be brought down to their conduct and plans. Well, there's double trouble now, because he had a good reputation, and so he's really going to let the side down and discredit the gospel. But the other way of looking at it, which our King James translators obviously favour, the way they've cast this, is this: a righteous man falling down before the wicked, in the sense of kowtowing to them, not doing what they do, but showing them excessive courtesy and affection and approval, is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring. He's sending a disastrous message. Let me give a simple illustration. Supposing somebody behaves badly in church, and we've had this, and I must say rarely, but it happens in every community of fallen people. Let's suppose we have somebody who really behaves abominably, and they've lied, and they've acted terribly proudly, and they've caused great upset and unhappiness, and they've been very, very sinful. And let's say they've stalked off and left us behind and insulted us at every opportunity. And then, because such people can be incredibly brazen, one day they come back and pay us a visit. And good people who didn't share their behaviour, let's say, throw their arms around them and kiss them and almost weep over them. "How lovely to see you. How wonderful you're here." That's what this proverb is about. A righteous man falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring. What's he or she said to that evildoer? Oh, you're all right, really. We love you. We endorse everything you ever did and said. We think you're fine. We agree with you. If only we had the courage to take the wonderful stand against this wicked church that you took. We endorse you and we love you. Well, that's terrible. That's encouraging them. It's making yourself a participant in their sin. What should have happened is courteous, yes, but rather reserved. We want to see how you behave. Rather reserved and polite, not endorsement and love and affection. That's all misplaced. And there are many applications of this. I have in mind a church not very far from here, into South London, and they had exactly this problem. They had a group of people who wanted to turn it into a completely contemporary church. And they caused lots of trouble, and then off they went. This is just a few years ago. And when they returned, with a wicked plan, when they returned, tragically, the people who suffered, these folk, received them back with open arms. And they brought in their pals and all the rest of it, and eventually voted out the minister and took over the church, and then all the better people had to leave. And there it is, just about 7 or 8 miles south of ours here, now a raving, continuous, contemporary church doing all the wrong things, and all the good people have had to go find other homes. And they know now they shouldn't have embraced those folk. They should have been very reserved, polite, courteous. And then when the opportunity arose, have you changed your mind? Have you changed your views? And they didn't do that. This is about ruling our spirit. Oh, but I used to like this person very much. So now's my opportunity to put the clock back as though nothing has happened and embrace the person. No, rule your spirit. Honour the principles of the word. Be careful. There was wickedness. So that's what this is about. A righteous man. I'm sure the King James Version have got the right end of the stick. Falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring, as an utterly wrong message pours forth. And that takes me back to verse 25, with apologies to Solomon. As cold waters to a thirsty soul, this will be our conclusion, so is good news from a far country. Now that text is used a lot. If we get a wonderfully encouraging missionary letter, we might refer to this text. As cold waters to a thirsty soul. Is that what Solomon had in mind? Not exactly. It's right on the theme, ruling your spirit. This is what it means. It's a wonderful proverb, but this is the meaning. You are a thirsty soul. You've been toiling in the Middle East in the heat of the sun for hours. And now somebody's drawn from a deep well refreshment, and it's cold water, and it's so pleasant, and it's so refreshing. That's a picture of life. Did you want the Christian life to be happy all the day? Well, it is in one way, but it isn't in other ways. It's full of work and trials. We have to spend so many hours of our day among unbelievers, sometimes in very difficult circumstances. Sin abounds. There are a lot of trials and difficulties. It's pictured by toiling in the heat of the sun. Just now and then, there's something really uplifting. You may be in exile, and it's news from home. You may have relations you haven't heard from, and they're far away, and there's news. What a picture of life. The real moments of tremendous uplift and joy are scattered like jewels along a pathway that is, on the whole, quite difficult. We're always happy in the Lord, I hope, but it's mostly difficult with just these uplifting moments. If you don't open your letters, you won't get any of them. Somebody comes, I've a message from you for a far country. I'm too busy toiling. I haven't got time. Well, that would be foolish, because that's what makes life. What makes life for the Christian is that there's a letter from a far country twice or three times on a Sunday. When we're in the house of God, when we're at worship, and we're in one another's company, and we're hearing the eternal word, this is our letter from a far country. Then there are other wonderful moments. Every day, we open our letter in our private devotions, and we get that time of refreshing and blessedness. And if you're married, husband, wife, you sit down together and read verses of scripture. It's your letter from a far country. This is the Christian life. If you skip it, you've lost the value of your letter for that day, and maybe the next day, and maybe the next day, and you're drifting apart. How foolish. Then there's Monday night prayer meeting and Wednesday night. I was talking to somebody the other day who was telling me, Pastor, that people are preaching less and less these days. Many, many churches now around the country, evangelical churches that a few years ago would have had two services on a Sunday and two in the week, with at least three messages a week. Now the regular pastor preaches only once a week, three times a month. This is becoming the standard. Amazing. There's great changes that have taken place. Well, if you're not at services, if you're not at Bible study, if you're never turning out when you could, if you're never reading the scriptures, if you're skipping devotions, this is how the Lord blesses us. He knows the Christian life is hard. That's why he's given us all these wonderful means of grace. And without them, you're in the hot fields, toiling all the time, without remission, without any blessing, without any uplift. That's what this means. We're ruling our spirits. As cold waters to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. And ultimately, that is the meaning of the proverb, that we need the means of grace. And the means of grace lift us up and enrich us and maintain the fires of Christian happiness and zeal and make all the other times light work to us. And it's true. Verse 28, he that hath no rule over his own spirit, no discipline, no self-management, is like a city that is broken down and without walls, and anything can come in. And if you see a Christian drifting off into the world, it's what's happened. The rule of the Spirit has broken down. The walls have collapsed. And all sorts of things are coming in. We've considered consideration for others, having some unbreachable barriers to help you see the desperate nature of wrongdoing, never to be casual, always to be deeply sympathetic and watch the tongue and the words, to control bitterness, to show disapproval of sin. We've considered these things and other things also. And in the spirit of the first proverb that we looked at in verse 16, "Hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee, but not too much." I'm moving off the book of Proverbs very soon and revisit it another time. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 447. Hymn number 447. "Jesus, my strength, my hope, on thee I cast my care."